All right. For those of you keeping track, there is a new rap battle on Facebook, just to let you know. Thank you, Mr. Smith. I watched it this morning before I came over, had a hearty laugh. Anyway, we are in Matthew chapter 17, verse 24 is where we're at. This text, I'll just be, well, prompts a lot of discussion, apparently. What is going on? Everybody all right? We good? All right. We're in Matthew chapter 17, verse 24. What did we talk about yesterday? Yes, the transfiguration. A major, major, major victory. But right after that, what was the situation that occurred? Yeah. And what in this healing of the demon-possessed boy, what did we discover once again about the disciples? Yeah, and Jesus says the reason why you weren't able to was because of your faith, which was saying what about them? That they didn't just love Him enough, or they didn't just hope enough? No, how do we define faith? Yes, the acknowledgement, the submission to the authority of Jesus, which means something about His identity. They're still functioning off of the wrong lens, is what the demoniac account loudly tells us. You're functioning off the wrong lens. And that's reconfirmed to us at the end of verse 23, after Jesus says, once again in verse 22 and 23, how His victory will be attained through His death and resurrection. How do the disciples react? They grieve. They move into a depression because He keeps saying the stupid stuff. And it is in that state, in this state of grieving, that we need to read this next text within that context, okay? Because I'll be honest with you, this next section, when I was writing it, it took me 3 days because these next three verses bothered me. I did not know what to do with them. But I think that we'll all be able to land on something today. We're going to spend half the time on just the first three verses, and then we're going to try to get all the way through chapter 18. But these three verses, these three or four verses, I guess would be four, 24 through 27. These four verses, a lot of times people think they're almost kind of throwaway verses. People accuse Paul of this a lot too, where they just say, oh, he just randomly threw this in. But what I'm finding is the more and more you study about the way in which the writers are writing and just scriptures in general, they don't do very many things randomly. They just don't. They have a reason. They have a flow of thought. They have a movement, a logical progression. And the same thing happens here. Let me read these verses, and then we'll dialogue about it. After Jesus and His disciples arrived in Capernaum, so He's back in His hometown, kind of hometown, base of operations. The collectors of the two drachma tax came to Peter and asked, "Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax?" "Yes, he does," he replied. When Peter came into the house, Jesus was the first to speak. "What do you think, Simon?" he asked. "From whom do the kings of the earth collect duty and taxes? From their own sons or from others?" "From others," Peter answered. "Then the sons are exempt," Jesus said to him. "But so that we may not offend them, go to the lake and throw out your line. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours." A lot of times when people are dialoguing about this text, what they basically use it for is they basically say, you know what, we should pay a tax because we don't want to offend, you know, our country or whatever, or the people that are over us. They try to use that as an apology for paying taxes, saying that, you know what, it's important for us to do because you just don't want to offend anybody. That's kind of weird at this point in Jesus' ministry. Isn't that an explanation a little strange? Why would I think that was a little peculiar? Say it again. Louder. He's what? It's kind of weird now, after 17 chapters of him kind of rowling some feathers, saying, hey, kingdom of heaven is here. It's way different. Matter of fact, you guys are, you know, way off base. But all of a sudden he's like, ooh, let's pay the tax. We don't want to offend anyone. Make sure we walk on eggshells. That's what we need to do. It's a little awkward. So what's happening here? Let's go back to verse 24 and ask an initial question. What is the two drachma tax? Two drachma tax is also referred to in rabbinic literature as the half shekel tax, and that really has something more to say about the way in which their money is divided than it does about the tax itself. Four drachmas equal one shekel. Therefore, if it's a two drachma tax, that means it would be a half shekel. It's merely conversion. But what is a drachma? Drachma is worth about one Roman denarius. What do we know about a Roman denarius? How much is that equivalent to? A day's wage. So this tax would be 2 days' wages. And for a peasant, that's a big deal. This is a tax on top of their tithe. This is a tax on top of the Roman taxes. And whatever you're dealing with, a peasant who literally is living day to day, what he makes that day is what his family eats. A two drachma tax is pretty oppressive, to be flat out honest with you. It's a big sacrifice. It's a pretty big deal. It does have ritual significance. We trace this tax back to Exodus chapter 30. Although I will say this, when the tax was originally implemented in the book of Exodus, the nation of Israel, as far as their peasants and their day laborers, were in a much different circumstance than they are under Roman law. Big difference. Under Roman rule, the taxes would eat up about 40% of somebody's wages with these taxes all put together. Back in the time in which this was implemented in Exodus, that was not the case. So some people would say, well, that's awful, get rude of God to be taking a tax away from these peasants and making it pay for the temple. When the tax was first instituted, it was a much different world. Things have happened in about 1,500 years. Political function, yada, yada, yada. Okay. Now let's keep moving on. So we know what the tax is, and we'll get to the function of taxes in the world, the ancient world as a whole. But right now, bottom line is, it was a two drachma tax that all Jews were expected to pay for the upkeep of the temple. But it would have been a stretch for anyone to keep this tax intact. I don't know if I can say that word, it makes sense. But they came to Peter and they asked this question. Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax? Peter replies, yes, he does. This, again, is where I wish we could hear the voice inflection. I wish I could see Peter's face. Because you see, this question in the Greek, this question... Well, first of all, let me say this. This is the very first time in the entire book of Matthew that an accusation or an inquiry about the actions of Jesus' kingdom directly targets Jesus. First time ever. It says, does your teacher pay the temple tax? Normally, how are the questions usually formed normally? Think chapter 12 with the Sabbath controversy, or before the Sabbath controversy. What's the question framed around? What's that? The disciples. How come your disciples do what is unlawful on the Sabbath? In chapter 15, when we're dealing with the cleansing of the hands, how is the question framed? How come your disciples violate the traditions of our elders by not washing their hands? Very first time that they come out and they say, does your teacher pay the temple tax? So right off the bat, you realize this is a different type of interaction than what we've had so far. I consider it a little more bold because of the way in which the word or the phrase is formed in Greek. The question that they ask is expecting an answer in the affirmative. The way it is framed, it's kind of like saying this, your teacher pays the temple tax, right? Which you would expect the answer to be, oh yeah, of course he does. Of course he does. And so a lot of times people think that whenever Peter says here, yes he does, he's trying to make sure he covers all of his bases. He's trying to protect Jesus, trying to stay out of trouble. But I don't think that's what's happening here. And the reason why is because of the relationship between Jewish rabbis and the temple tax. If you were an officially ordained and recognized Jewish rabbi in the kingdom of Israel, you were exempt from the temple tax. You didn't pay it. And so what you have here all of a sudden is this happening. So you follow Jesus, huh, Peter? And Peter, who's coming off of a moment where he's grieving because of what his teacher keeps saying, they say, let me ask you this. You follow Jesus, but does your teacher have to pay the temple tax? What's that doing? What's that saying? Yeah, it's saying he's not even a real rabbi, Peter. I mean, the very fact that he has to pay the temple tax should let you know that the guy you're following is a scam. He's a sham. I mean, my word. Does he pay the temple? And what does Peter have to say? Yeah, he does. And in his situation, his context of grieving, what do you think that does for Peter? Does it build up his confidence? No, which is, I think, is one of the reasons why when Peter came into the house, verse 25 says, Jesus was the first to speak. Because maybe the way Peter walked in, Jesus knew, okay, there's doubt setting in. He's starting to think I'm really not it. Because you see, Jesus keeps saying stuff that the Messiah shouldn't be saying. Because you know what? Elijah was supposed to come first. Something's not right here. I mean, your teacher has to pay the temple tax. He's not even exempt. So Peter comes in, a little bit down, and Jesus says, What do you think, Simon? What do you think? He says, from whom do the kings of the earth collect duty and taxes? From their sons or from others? What this is describing is the basic principle of taxation in the ancient world. The basic principle. Taxes were a way of exerting dominance. Whenever you took over a people, you would force them to pay taxes. Why? So that every time they pay it, it reminds them who is the boss. It reminds them who is in charge. It reminds them that they are inferior. They are not the ones that are calling the shots. They are the ones that are being told what to do and where to go and how to do it. Taxes in the ancient world. This is the reason why in AD 66, when the Jewish rebellion started to occur, the first thing they did was stopped paying taxes and started minting their own coins. That's rebellion language. That's rebellion acts. Because taxes say something bigger. Because you are literally, as the subject of a kingdom, you are literally paying for the machinations of the kingdom that is oppressing you. You're paying for their lifestyles. You're praying for them, or you're not praying, but you're paying for them to be able to continue to dominate you. You are paying for their armies to stay in existence, the ones that have you under their thumb. That's what taxes do. And so Jesus asked him, he says, now let me ask you this question. Who are the taxes taken from? Do you take it from your sons? You take it from the others. And Peter gets it right. Peter says, from others. What has Jesus just said right then? What category are they putting us in, Peter? Are they saying that we're the sons of God? Are they saying that we are the sons of the kingdom? No. Why? All you have to do is look at who they're expecting the taxes to come from. We're the others, Peter. Just like the prostitute, we are the others. Just like the leper, we are the others. Just like the children and the women, we are the others. In their eyes, Peter, we are the others. Jesus says, yeah, then the sons are exempt, right? But so that we may not offend them, actually the word there, offend is a terrible word there. This word is, as a matter of fact, it'll be used in just a bit about those that cause little ones to sin. Same word. It's the word for to lead someone astray or to cause them to sin. This is where in 1 Corinthians, whenever Paul is talking about being all things to all people, he does that so that he doesn't cause anyone to stumble or to offend them. That's a terrible word. You see the difference in that? In other words, Jesus says, so that they don't miss the point, because that we are others in their kingdom. That's true, actually. We're going to pay the tax. But now watch how he pays the tax. So that we may not lead them astray or cause them to sin, or to make them think that we are not others, or to make them think that we belong to the Jewish elite of their kingdom, because we don't. That's not who we are. Go to the lake and throw out your line, O good fisherman. Maybe there's a moment in there where Jesus is kind of saying, do you want to go back to that? Do you want to go back to that? Because maybe you won't throw the line just once. Maybe you'll just stay there and just keep fishing. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4-drachma coin. Why is that insignificant? 4-drachma coin. What? Yeah, it's double the amount of the tax. And Jesus says, precisely, take it and give it to them for my tax and yours. Let's piece this together. In the ancient world, a key symbol of sovereignty was the fish. The fish. In Marshall Epigrams 4:30.4-5, it says, as Domitian is walking by this river, a fish comes up onto the shore, hoping, desiring, wishing to lick the hand of the emperor. What is that describing? A psychotic fish? Or the sovereignty that Domitian holds even over the animals we can't even see in the sea? In Juvenal, 4th Satire, 1:63-128, a large fish was given to Domitian, and he is called, when it's given to him, the ruler of lands and seas and nations. And the reason why they said that this fish was given to him, this humongous fish, was it's because the fish wished to be caught by the ruler of the lands and of the seas. Sovereignty. Same thing in the Jewish world. In Tobit 6:2, Tobias, no, that is not a name originated with Arrested Development. It comes from Tobit. A large fish startles him. He's startled. The fish comes up, and apparently it's an enormous fish. He's like, it's going to eat me, and he's freaking out. And this angel says, no, get the fish. And he ends up using the fish to free the maiden that is held by this demonic force that's already killed 6 of her husbands. The fish, God's provision in his sovereignty, to give him power and authority over the demonic force through using the entrails of this large fish. Fish was something that used for sovereignty. In the book of Matthew, where has fish emerged? The answer is 3 times. Where are they? Feeding of the 5,000, which emphasizes what? God's sovereignty and provision, right? Where else? Feeding of the 4,000, which emphasizes God's sovereignty and provision. One more time. What? Chapter 4. Oh, technically, yeah, you are right there. You are right there. And well, yes. Does it use the word fish or fishermen? They're catching fish. I'll buy that. Anyway, and that whole story also is about God's sovereignty too, because he tells them to come and they follow. Where's the other one? So there's 4. Say it again.
Parable of the net.
Parable of the net? My goodness, there's like 5 or 6. I only grabbed 3 off the top of my head. Apparently I was way wrong. Parable of the net again. In that story, what is it about?
Judgment.
Judgment, but God's sovereignty to make his kingdom victorious even in the face of evil. Here is the other one I thought of. And this one's obviously more obscure than the clear ones that I missed. Chapter 7, verse 10, in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is talking about you as an earthly father. If your child asks you for a fish, would you give him a snake? If he asks you for some bread, would you give him a stone? What's that emphasizing? God's sovereign provision to take care of his children because he loves them. Fish equals sovereignty language in the ancient world and in the Gospel of Matthew. Yes?
Would that at all be comparing the two kingdoms? I mean, the serpent being Satan and the fish being...
Possibly. That's possibly. Although I don't think that the word for serpent there is the same one that you'd find in like Genesis 3 in the Septuagint. Because I think this one would be office. I think it'd be different. But you know, you could possibly say that conceptually. The point though here is this. Fish equals sovereignty. And he tells them, go to the lake, throw in a line, and catch a fish, and there will be your tax. Who's paying the tax then? Say it again.
God.
See, this is the beauty of what Jesus does. In paying the tax, they are not submitting to the sovereign story of the kingdom of Israel. They're not. They're submitting to the story of the kingdom that Jesus has brought. Because what they're saying is this. These people think they're in control. They think that we are the others, that we are the outsiders because of their tax. You know what? God's going to pay this tax. And every time you pay the tax, it is not you saying, I trust your sovereignty, Almighty Kingdom. It is you saying, I trust the sovereignty of God that even paying my tax, even in the face of that evil, we are still victorious. All of a sudden, the payment of the tax becomes a subversive act. It becomes something where you're saying, no, I'm paying the tax because I trust God even that much. That I will even give money to the oppressive empire, knowing that everything they do is in His control. That even as outsiders of their kingdom, we are still the ones that are victorious. Even as the others, not the sons. We know the true story. We know who the true sons are. Because they are the ones that are blessed. Blessed are the... You see what's happening? Jesus says, pay the tax. Because in paying the tax, you're actually showing your reliance on God, not on them. So instead of this tax being something where Peter's like, oh, we don't want to make him upset. Please, Jesus, how are we going to get the money? And he says, I don't know, go catch a fish. And oh, what do you know, it's there. Instead of that, Jesus is saying, listen, I know that you're grieving right now because the stuff I'm teaching you is pretty rough. And I know their question shamed you because they were shaming me. But I'm telling you, our God is sovereign. And paying the tax is a way of you loudly proclaiming that that's what you believe. Not that they're in control, but that He's in control. Do you see the difference? All right, I'm comfortable with that. Because I wasn't comfortable with it the other day. And this is going to make sense now why we move into this whole discussion of who is the greatest in the kingdom. Because we've just asked the question about who are the sons, who are the others. The others would not be considered the greatest. The sons would be. And now Jesus says, let's talk about who's the greatest in the kingdom. Let's discuss this. And this is going to kick off the fourth major discourse in the Gospel of Matthew. Chapter 18, verse 1. This is the fourth major discourse. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, well then, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? If it's not the Jewish elite, and if we aren't even considered sons, who is the greatest? And Jesus called a little child, and He had him stand among them, and He said, I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me. But if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a large millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. So much for this, you know, little pansy Jesus. He gets a little rowdy. Why? For what? For the outcast of the kingdom. What are children in the ancient world? Parasites. There can be no better category to describe the worthless least of these in the ancient kingdom than children. None. Jesus says, who is the greatest in my kingdom? I'm going to go down to the very bottom of the barrel. It's children. And we think nowadays, like, oh, how could he say that? They're so wonderful and awesome. Not in their world, because all that children were liabilities. The only thing they could do is lose honor for their family, and the only thing that they do besides that is just take up all the resources. So while the father is out slaving all day in the fields, he has to come back and give the money to, or give the food to his child, who isn't doing anything to help the family progress. This is why it was encouraged by the emperors to, you know what? Don't have as many children. If you have more than what you want, you can just throw them out in the sewers as an infant. That is legal. Or you can go through abortion. Sometimes they'll kill you, but you know what? It's better than having a kid. Jesus says, who is the greatest in the kingdom? The ones that the other kingdoms throw away. That's the greatest. And I'll tell you something. He would look so foolish talking that protective of a child. He'd look like a moron. Saying if anybody makes them falter. Man, you know what? They'd rather the mafia just got a hold of them and left them in the sea. That they just, it'd be better for them to have that happen. Because you don't mess with the greatest in the kingdom. You don't mess with it. Because when you do, the king gets a little upset. But the greatest in this kingdom are children. How foolish. Verse 7. Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to sin. Such things must come, but woe to the man through whom they come. If your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life maimed or crippled than to have two hands or two feet and be thrown into the fire, eternal fire. Would anybody agree with that? It's better to be in life crippled? Because what category then does that put you? The outcasts. It's better for you to be an outcast. No, it's not. Yes, it is. Because the others is where the greatest of the kingdom resides. Verse 9, and if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life with one eye, half blind, than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell. See that you do not look down on one of these little ones. He's still talking in the context of sin and of the greatest in the kingdom. For I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father in heaven. In other words, the ones that they consider as the worst, the outcast, they're actually closer to God than any of us. Their angels are always before the face of God in heaven. What do you think? Verse 12. If a man owns 100 sheep and one of them wanders away, will he not leave the 99 on the hills and go to look for the one that wandered off? A lot of times we try to take this as an evangelistic parable. Is it used that way in other contexts in different gospels? Yes. In Matthew's gospel, it's not. It's talking about how much God treasures the greatest in his kingdom. The little ones. The outcasts. Verse 13, and if he finds it, I tell you the truth, he is happier about that one sheep than about the 99 that did not wander off. In the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should be lost. In other words, what he's saying is this. The value system of the kingdom of God is different than the value system of the kingdoms of this world. It's different. They measure the value system based on who pays the tax. That's not how we base our value system. They measure the value system of the greatest in their kingdoms by the people that are sitting on thrones and the ones that have the most money. That's not how we base the value in our kingdom of who is the greatest. It's upside down. It doesn't make sense. It sounds foolish. But this is the way our kingdom moves. This is the way we grow. This is how we gain victory. It's almost kind of like saying this. The kingdom of this world will think they've been victorious when they hang me on a tree. But baby, I'm telling you, that's how we win. See, I don't think it's an accident that 17, 22 through 23 is what precedes this whole conversation of a value mix-up. because they're about to see a cross in which they will think is the penultimate of domination. And Jesus says, well, yeah, for our kingdom, not for theirs. We're going to go ahead and plow through these next couple ones. I know I'm at my time, but give me two more minutes. If your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you have won your brother over, Jeremy. But if he will not listen to you, take one or two others along so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. He's laying down a process by which our kingdom functions. Because sin is an issue that we deal with. We don't ignore. We're looking out for each other. And to say that, do not judge lest you be judged, that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about damnation. We're talking about brothers and sisters that are clearly in sin. And if we turn a blind eye, we cannot be considered their brothers and sisters. We are their enemies because we're letting them walk down a path of destruction and we don't even care. I'm sorry, I don't want you as a brother or sister if that's the way it is. Hold on a second, I got to keep moving. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, treat him as you would a pagan or a tax collector. Matthew knows a little bit about that. I tell you the truth. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. That's big authority talk. That's some high responsibility that we've been given right there. Again, I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. Really? That means I can ask for $1 million with me and my friend and we'll get it? No, you're ignoring context. He's talking about church discipline. He's not talking about money. He says, whatever two or three of you ask for, it will be given to you. In what context? Binding and loosing on earth in the context of sin and church discipline. For where two or three of you come together in my name, there I am I with you, them. Oh my goodness. There am I with them. Let me give you the quick explanation of this verse that's usually used in regards to church attendance. Usually you hear this verse whenever a couple of you come to this prayer gathering. They're supposed to have 50 and there's only three of you. And the most holy one will come up out of the group and he'll say, but remember, where two or three are gathered, there Jesus is also. And you know, everybody's like, oh, you're right. You know, we go in and we do it anyway because that's the holy thing to do. We use this verse for church attendance. It makes us feel good. As if you're the only one in the room, Jesus isn't there. Because, you know, it's where two or three are gathered. You know, I had my friend paint this picture, and it's this little girl that's sitting in this room, and Jesus is peeking his head around the corner, and the caption says, I wish somebody else would come so Jesus could come in. Because that's the idiocy of applying that passage in that context. This passage has nothing to do with church attendance. It has to do with the court of law. For in the Old Testament, in order for a sin to be considered legitimate, or in order for an accusation to be validated in the court of law, there must have been two to three witnesses, right? And if two or three witnesses were there, hence the reason why two or three witnesses had to be trumped up for Jesus, even though he was innocent, at his trials, then the accusation was considered valid. Therefore, in context, this verse is about church discipline. Where two or three come together, disciplining a person that after going to them one-on-one, after going to them with a group, after bringing them before the church, they are still obstinate in their sin. They still refuse to repent. Then Jesus says, what you bind on earth is bound in heaven. In other words, they are kicked out until they repent. Why? Because our kingdom's purity, our community's vitality, our community's faithfulness is that important. Because if we are a kingdom that is divided, we will fall. And the brother may think, well, that's the most judgmental thing you can do, kicking me out of the community. But what they don't realize, that is the most gracious thing that you can do. It's kind of like Eden. Because the goal is not to kick people out. The goal is to get them to return. The goal is to get them to repent. Can this be abused? Yes. But has it been absolutely ignored and neglected? Yes. And we wonder why our churches are such a mess. Because we don't even take the purity of our people seriously. And hear me whenever I say that really quick. Sorry. When I'm saying purity of our people, I'm not talking about drinking, smoking, and going with girls that do those crazy things. I'm talking about things like materialism. You know? You know, our brother over here can't even make ends meet on his rent. His family may or may not have heat during this winter season that's coming up. But I've got a rock that could pay their rent for a year on my finger. Really? Love you guys. You're dismissed. Have a good weekend.